Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Prospering in a Recession. We invite our audience to visit us often on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now to introduce our speaker. Victor Chang is a graduate of Stanford University, a former McKinsey consultant, and a guest lecturer at the Harvard Business School. He has been featured by the Fox Business Television Network, MSNBC, The Wall Street Journal, Smart Money, and many other publications and programs as an expert on marketing in a recession, with an emphasis on showing business owners and professionals how to survive and even thrive during tough economic times. Victor is the author of the newly released book, The Recession-Proof Business, Lessons from the Great Recession Success Stories of All Time. Please join me in welcoming Victor Chang.
Good evening. I'm going to do something I don't normally do. I'm going to do a quick survey of the room. I just want to get a feel for who's in the room, and I'm going to tailor my talk based on who's here. How many of you are business owners? Raise your hands. Okay. How many of you are in nonprofit organizations? Intentionally, legally, not-for-profit organizations. I should clarify. Either. How many of you are in government-based organizations? Okay, members of the media? Great. What I'm going to talk about is, I'm going to share with you some of the research I've done on the past 12 U.S. recessions going back about 136 years. My original research was geared towards business owners. I'll try to tailor it to all types of organizations and even to professionals who are employees, because the rules of what it takes to survive and thrive in recession are really very universal and very broadly applicable. So forgive me if some of my examples are business-oriented, but the lessons are really very widely applicable. You know, in every great recession or every great crisis, there's always a sort of defining moment, right? And, you know, for terrorism, it was September 11th. For this particular financial crisis, it was actually, for me, it was September 10th. And that was the day that Lehman Brothers announced they were having some small issues, which is, I think, the term I recall hearing on the TV. And the reason I remember it so well was I was actually about to go on air in a national television broadcast for Fox, providing, ironically, some commentary on what the banks need to do to survive in this particular environment. My segment got bumped back about 10 minutes for the late-breaking news, and then pretty much 72 hours later, all hell broke loose, and the global economies of the world lost trillions and trillions of dollars in the next 36 days. And when that happened, there was sort of this moment of panic that at least I felt, and I'm sure many in the room felt as well. And my first reaction when I don't know what to do about something is to go find someone who's been through it before. Okay? The only problem was once we sort of realized this crisis was going to be so severe, the only people who had this experience of running a business successfully in a recession of this magnitude were people over the 100 years of age. Right? And so it was very limited supply, if you would, of this expertise. And I started a research project originally for just my own selfish benefit. I wanted to know, what did people do in the past 12 recessions, going back 136 years? What did they do to make it? Okay? And what can I learn from that to apply to my own business? And I also started sharing, once I did that research, I was sort of very excited by what I discovered. Started sharing that information with some of my clients, started giving speeches on that, wrote a book on it. At this point, I've given probably 30 speeches by the end of this year. And clearly, it was a much hotter topic than I originally had anticipated. And what the good news is, to survive a recession, the formula for surviving a recession, even actually thriving in a recession, it's formulaic. It's a recipe. And that's what I've learned from history. You follow four rules, and your business, your organization, survives. And the bulk of my talk will be about those four rules. But first, I want to talk a little bit about the economy overall. Because I always get questions, so I thought I'd just address that really quickly. So let me give you a four-minute version of what's really going on with the economy. Both the good and the bad, no Pollyannish, the gentleman's comment earlier today, and then we'll move into like what do we do about it as professionals, as business owners. The essence of why we have a recession today is very simple. This recession was caused by two things. As a country, which means government, businesses, and consumers, we borrowed a whole bunch of money, and then we just spent it. Okay. Now the reason this recession is so severe is fairly simple. The amount of money we borrowed was incredibly high, and the level of spending we spent was incredibly high as well. So the severity of the recession is equally severe. Okay, that is it in a nutshell. Now, there's a couple things that it's important to realize about both the long-term as well as the short-term prospects for our economy. When you look at the level of debt we've had in this country, consumer debt, government debt, corporate debt, all added together, and you compare it to our income as a nation, okay, you will see this chart, and this chart looks very interesting. If you plot out the amount of debt we've had in this country over a period of about 100 years, what you're going to find is that the debt in about 1900s started about this level, okay? And right around the Great Depression, it skyrocketed, okay, right to about here. And then the generation that went through that, they sort of learned their lesson, right? And they pinched and they saved, and they were very frugal with their money, okay? And the level of debt went down dramatically right around when we had the big boom, you know, back in the 60s. And what happened right around the 80s is the debt stayed fairly low. And right around the 80s, the debt started creeping up and up all the way to the year 2008, where the level of debt in this country was about almost double what we had in the Great Depression. Okay? So there's a lot of argument about, are we in the Great Recession, the Great Depression, the Mini Depression? And legitimately speaking, you could argue for this being called the Great Depression times two, right? And you would have some factual basis in making that claim. And what's important to realize is a couple of things. The long-term prospects of our economy is driven by the amount of debt we have, okay? Because when you have a lot of debt, you have to pay a lot of interest, and your money doesn't go into building new industries. It goes into paying off interest, okay? Now, the short-term prospects, though, of our economy is very different, right? In the short run, we can buy ourselves out of a recession, which is essentially what the Obama administration is doing. But one thing is very certain. When you spend $1 trillion to bail ourselves out of a recession, one thing is factually incontrovertible, and that is you still owe $1 trillion, okay? And it has to get paid back. So if you look at the level of debt we have in this country, in a lot of ways, we are now at a worse level of debt than we were at the start, okay? So from a long-term standpoint, that causes some uncertainty. In the short run, it'll probably make this particular recession shorter. Does that make sense? Okay. So what should you expect from an economy standpoint next couple of years? I've been telling everyone to expect the unexpected, okay? When will this recession end? No one really knows, although there's no shortage of people who are willing to guess. I've been doing a lot of TV work this year, and I've sort of been very intrigued by what gets you on TV, okay? And it's not about accuracy, I'll tell you that. It's about having an opinion, okay? About being willing to vocalize an opinion and being really good for ratings. That helps a lot. Okay? And having enough credibility to sort of legitimately be there. Okay? But it's not about accuracy. Okay? And so what happens is if you look at this particular recession and who forecasted it, you'll find that about 500 economists tracked this stuff, 498 got it wrong. The two that got it right, they got the last seven wrong. Okay? So we're not really good at forecasting this stuff, and you shouldn't put a lot of weight into it. Okay? What you should do is learn to expect the unexpected. Okay? Let me give you a couple scenarios of what might happen. We could have what's called a flat recovery. Okay? So the recession technically ends in a quarter or two, which I think is a possibility of, technically. But 1 out of 10 Americans is still unemployed for years and years and years. It's a possibility. We could have another scenario where all the trillion dollars we spent on stimulus kicks in, drives ourselves out of the recession. Okay? But in 2011, we don't have that stimulus anymore, and the long-term problems of this economy come back, and we have what's called a double-dip recession. Okay? So think of it as a recession with a vacation for a year or two and another recession. It's happened a couple times in history before. That's right. So it's important to realize that that's a possibility. A third possibility that I think is possible is we just continually stimulate our way out of each recession from here on out. Okay? Because we've sort of at this precipice, when it crashes, it hurts a lot, right? So from any political leader standpoint, that's bad for votes. It's bad for the country. In that particular case, we might have a situation with hyperinflation. Right, we keep borrowing money, we borrow an extra trillion every 2 years to bail ourselves out, and at some point we max out our collective credit limit for this country when we have hyperinflation. And that creates all kinds of, a very different kind of chaos, but it is nonetheless very chaotic. So those are sort of the scenarios, and which one's right, I have not a clue. It could be any of the three, it could be something entirely different. But my message to you is to be prepared for the unexpected, and I think the reason a lot of businesses, a lot of organizations, and even, frankly, a lot of governments, like our state, great state here, were not prepared for the unexpected. And they got hit very, very hard because they sort of managed their operations too close to the edge, where it doesn't take much to throw you off course. that's my five-minute tutorial on the economy. And so let's talk about what do you do about that. And here's my take. My take from a business standpoint is that in every kind of economy, there are always winners and losers. Okay? In a boom economy, companies go out of business. Hundreds of thousands of companies go out of business in a boom economy. Okay? The opposite is equally true. There are businesses who succeed and grow in down economies. I just saw a study the other day published by MSN, MSNBC. They cited a study where roughly half of Fortune 500 companies were started in a recession. Okay? And the majority of the years of our history have been good years, not down years. Yet half of the companies that are big in this country started in a recession. And all the examples of the companies I'll share with you tonight and that are in my book were all companies that started as two, three, four-person small businesses that grew on to become Fortune 500 companies. Okay? So there is opportunity in there. So let's talk about the four rules of building a recession-proof business, organization, or career. There are four rules. The first rule has four parts. The rest are more simple. So if you're taking notes, you can kind of structure your notes that way. The first message to this is that in a recession, the companies that make it are the ones that focus on the opportunities that remain and emerge in recession, not on the opportunities that went away. Okay? So the companies that survive and prosper focus on what's still working in the recession, not on the problems with the economy overall. Let me give you an example. The first tip in remembering this rule is to recall that there's still a lot of money out there. There's a lot of money out there. You know, at the start of this recession, the economy was running about $14 trillion for U.S. GDP. And this recession will probably shrink the economy overall probably about 5 or 6%, okay? Which, by historical standards, is about five times worse than our typical recession. So the recession you and I are used to in our lifetimes, anyone under the age of probably 80, the typical recession, this will be worse by about fivefold. Okay? But that means that 95% of the economy still remains. And when you do the math, that means there's roughly $13.3 trillion of economic spending still residing inside our economy after we've hit rock bottom. Okay? And so to give you some perspective, if you're taking notes, write out $13.3 trillion, all the commas and all the zeros. I'll do it with you. Okay? It's like this. It goes like this. 1, 3, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, And so my question to you is, for your organization, for your personal business, personal needs, how much of that $13.3 trillion do you really need, right, to meet your financial obligations for this year? And does not enough exist out there in that $13.3 trillion that you could arguably get some of that for yourself? My argument is that enough does exist. But the trick is going after it. The rules for going after are a little bit different. What we have to realize is the inner recession, it's not the shrinkage of spending that hurts most people. It is the fact that the priorities and how the money is spent, what it is spent on, has changed. Okay, so let me give you an example. The U.S. auto industry. Most people know that new car sales have dropped about 50%, okay, which is pretty severe. And if you pay attention to the mainstream media, that's all you ever hear. What you don't hear is that used car sales have skyrocketed during this time. What you don't hear is that U.S. auto repair sales have gone up. Okay? Because the fact remains, there are the same number of driver's licenses out there, same number of people who still need to drive, okay, and they got to get from point A to point B. But their preference on how they're willing to do that has changed. It is the preference change that is killing the U.S. auto industry in a lot of ways. It is not the fact that the economy has shrunk. Does it make sense? So what happens is, imagine yourself in business, sitting in front of a place of business where you're in front of what I call the river of money. And the river of money is my analogy for spending out in the economy. And for decades, you sat in front of your porch, in front of the river of money, and you watched the money go by. And whenever you wanted some, you went out there, you got your cup, and you picked some up. Okay? And life was good. And then one day, something interesting happens. Okay? The river of money runs dry. There's no more money or water flowing in front of that river, in front of your place of business. So what are you supposed to do? What happened? Okay. Here's what did not happen. The amount of water out there hasn't really changed that much. It's changed a little bit. It's gone down by a little bit. What's really happened is the flow of that money has changed upstream. Okay? It's been re-diverted. So your riverfront property, which is your business, your career, is no longer in the right place. And you have two choices. You can sit there, like a lot of people do, and complain and whine about it and ask for a bailout and wonder when it's going to happen. That's one option. It's not the one I recommend. Okay? The other option is to go out and find the money. Okay? Go out into the marketplace. Is it over here? Are businesses doing better over here? Are customers in this particular sector of the economy doing better? Right? And trying to figure out where the money went, because it's still there. It is fundamentally still there, most of it. Okay? So that's really important to remember, and that's what the smart companies do and the people who manage their careers smartly. They go find where the money went. So that's my first tip in terms of following this rule of focusing on the opportunities in recession and not on the problems. Let me give you some other tips. Quickly speaking, you've got to be careful of the media, and particularly the daily news media. There's a huge bias in the daily news media to focus on negative events, mostly because as human beings, we pay more attention to bad news than good news. So like going down 101 or 101 in particular, have you ever noticed that sometimes there's like no real legitimate reason for a traffic jam? Right? There's some guy who has like a flat tire on the side of the road, and 10,000 cars have to slow down to watch. Okay? When on the same day, at the same time, the prior day, there was no car on the side of the road. There was no bad news. Nobody slowed down to watch. Okay? Interesting idea. Yesterday, 4,000 planes landed safely in this country. News at 11. Right? How often do you hear about good news? And it's not really the media's fault. It's because they're in a business. And their business is driven by getting us to pay attention. And as human beings, just by nature, we pay more attention to threats than we do to good news. Good news we sort of take in stride. With threats, we stop and pay attention. So that's my second tip. Beware of the media. Third tip is to remember that in this economy, you have to focus on adapting. If you don't adapt, you are seriously at risk of your business, your organization, dying. Okay? And the best story I can share with this is there's this one economist who did a really interesting analysis of the New York City high-priced call girl industry. Okay? And he asked a very interesting question. He asked, what happens to that industry when there's a stock market crash? Do they go unemployed? Do they make less money? Do they have health benefits? I'm serious. He asked these questions. Economics was not this interesting when I went to school. And he actually followed 300 high-priced call girls over a period of 15 years through three stock market crashes, plotting everything from do you have health benefits, are you employed, unemployed, how many clients do you have, what's your average price point, how many clients do you have per month, mapped out the entire economics of that industry, much like an MBA or financial analyst would from Wall Street. And what was interesting is when you look at the market crashes, I was shocked to find out what the best-selling service is amongst the high-priced call girls of New York City, the ones that service and cater to the Wall Street executives. I was shocked to learn the best-selling service in a market crash. It's listening. See, here's the stereotypical story. Wall Street executive, typically male, stereotypically anyway, loses $500 million on Monday. Very unhappy. Okay? Can't tell stereotypical trophy wife, because trophy wife will leave him, okay? But is still unhappy. Goes to regular call girl, too depressed to have sex, okay? Sex don't sell in a market crash. What is a girl to do? Okay? The ladies of the oldest profession on planet Earth survive for a reason. They adapt, so they never die, okay? It is easier to sell $10,000 per hour, therapy services, the folks who are depressed, than it is to sell anything else. So they change. They go with the times. They always survive. Okay? And they are ultimately really in the business of selling what sells. And that's it. And ultimately, all of us should be in the exact same business. We ought to sell what sells. Whether that's selling products or services to our customers or selling your own personal labor to an employer or prospective employers, you want to sell what sells, because that is a safe place to be in a recession. Okay, let's move on to rule number two. Rule number two is what I call turn the trend into your friend. And here's what I mean. Customer trends change in a recession, and you want to profit from that trend rather than just suffer from the trend. Most people are very familiar with the suffering part. I want to talk about how you actually profit from it. And I can do that by giving you some examples. A company called Federal Express was started in 1973 in the midst of the great oil crisis. And at that time, their second or third largest cost, which was jet fuel, tripled in price. Their price point was probably 20 times higher than the Postal Service. And they launched with a marketing campaign that said, use FedEx because we'll save you money. Right? And the odd thing is it worked. Right? And here's why. When FedEx first started, Fred Smith, the founder of FedEx, noticed a very interesting trend. He noticed a couple things. First trend he noticed is that in a recession, big companies lay off employees. Okay, who was aware of this fact? Okay, raise your hand. Big company. So this is not a brilliant insight so far. Agreed? Second thing he noticed was when big companies lay off employees, the work still stays. Okay? Still has to get done. Second observation. Third observation he made was when the work stays, big companies like to buy big computing systems, big computers, to automate the work that remained after these companies laid off employees. You guys with me so far? Okay. This is not rocket science, right? Okay. Here's the last little bit that basically every person in America missed except for him. What happens when the computers fail? Now that there are no people around, who's going to do the work? Okay. And what he discovered, because he was based out in the Northeast, where the headquarters of IBM and Xerox were located. IBM and Xerox, what they were doing was chartering airplanes. Fred Smith was a pilot. So he hung out at the local airport, and he noticed all these planes were flying empty without passengers and couldn't figure out why, so he kept doing some homework. And they were renting out entire airplanes for the cost of $2,000 to $3,000 to send a small, you know, one-pound computer part to, say, Atlanta, to Coca-Cola headquarters, because their service contracts guaranteed that if a computer should fail, IBM and Xerox would absolutely, positively fix it by the next business morning. Okay? And chartering aircraft at $3,000 per part was the way they did it. Okay? Notice the trend. The more there's a recession, the more layoffs there are. The more layoffs, the more reliant businesses are on computers. The more computers that are out there, the more that will ultimately fail. Okay? They have to be repaired. Fred Smith said, you know, I think I could do it for less than $3,000. Okay? Use FedEx, and we'll save you money. Okay? And they did. It was one of his very first customer segments. You see how the trend? You can see the trend, right? We all know the layoff trend, but we only see the negative consequences of that trend. He was the only person in America who noticed the upside. Okay? But it was all there for all of us to see, but he was the only one who bothered to notice it. All right, let me give you some practical sort of small business examples. I've been giving speeches across the country the past couple of months, and I remember being in Plano, Texas, and a guy who owned a small business that manufactures and installs retail store signs. Right, so you go to see like a new store that's in town, a new restaurant, they have the signs that are lit up at night. And that was his business. And he said, you know, interesting thing has happened. Retail stores are a lousy place to be. There aren't a lot of them being opened right now. So that part of his business has been suffering, he told me. But he said, you know, there's two parts of my business that I've actually been doing kind of well, you know, and I've been focusing on them. And he explained that he now sells and is probably the largest seller of going out of business signs in Plano, Texas, because the prevailing trend is businesses going out of business, but they still have to sell their inventory. So he manufactures and installs those signs. Why? Because he's selling what's selling. Right? Second thing you notice was, you know, once those retail stores go out of business, the landlord wants to get those properties filled again. Okay? But if they leave the old tenant signs up, it looks like it's occupied. So a prospective tenant won't stop by, inquire, and like offer to sign a lease. So he started a thriving sort of sub-business, if you would, on sign removal services. He's got the insurance for it. He's got the trucks. He's got the ladders. He's got the staff. And he is selling what is selling. Okay? You see, it's very subtle, right? We all know that stores aren't opening. He's the only one in Plano, Texas to notice that, well, who's going to take care of that problem? He turned the trend into his friend. Okay? Another example, I have a client who is a commercial real estate agent, which also in a lot of ways is a lousy business, right? And for most of his career, he was an agent that would help you buy a commercial property, a shopping center, a unit within a shopping center, that kind of stuff, or an office building. And that's not doing so well in his part of the country, much like many parts of the country. And working with him, I sort of noticed that he had an expertise in negotiating leases. He'd been doing it for decades, maybe 30 years in total. And I sort of nudged him and encouraged him to focus on the opposite side. One of the weird things that's happened in this particular recession is it's so bad and so severe that landlords are completely freaking out, okay, on the commercial side. There's an article that Starbucks had hired an army of lawyers to go back and renegotiate all the commercial leases for all the properties in every location in the United States. And even for the leases that expired in 5 years, they were having that and trying to renegotiate them right now. And the weird thing was it was working. I was like, interesting, that's a trend. I know how to do that. Like, he doesn't work for the big companies, he works for small companies. So he developed a business around renegotiating leases on behalf of small business owners. Okay? Leases that have not yet expired, might be expiring in 2, 3, or 4 years. And these are leases that would not have been ever been renegotiable in his entire career. But now the landlords in his area are so desperate, they're willing to proactively break the lease on their end just to renegotiate it to keep their spots filled. Okay? He turned the trend into his friend. Does that make sense? Okay. So that was rule two, turn the trend into your friend. Let's talk about rule three. Rule three is to solve customer problems in a unique way. The reason this is important, whether your customer is literally a customer or a client, or maybe your customer is just your employer, the reason it's important to be unique is because it makes your competitors less relevant. Okay? So let me give you an example. Who here has been to a Costco? Raise your hand. Okay, pretty much everyone in the room. Costco, as you might, some of you might know, started off originally as Price Club. Price Club and Costco merged, I think, in maybe the early 90s, late 80s, and they took on the Costco name. But the whole industry was started by Sol Price in my hometown, San Diego. And I didn't realize at the time, when I was a kid, we used to shop at the local Price Club, as it was called back then. And it was the very first Price Club ever started, so it was really quite interesting. And I remember going in there for the very first time and realizing just what a bizarre sort of business, you know, Price Club really was. And, you know, Price Club is not in the business of selling you what you want really cheap. They're in the business of selling you way more than you need really cheap. Okay, you get this, right? So this is unique. And what happened is you go in there and you just can't believe it. For a second, you can't believe two things. One is, why would I buy a 25-pound bag of sugar? And second is, why, how can it only cost like $3, right? And you have to just like mentally process. And for those of you who are in business and those of you who are looking for jobs, I'll tell you the number one reason why you either get rejected in terms of being an applicant for a job or why you get rejected when you're trying to solicit new business. Most of the people on the other side are in what I call autopilot rejection mode. Okay? They think they know what you're about at first glance, and they just flat out ignore you. Okay? So if you offer CPA services and you introduce yourself, I'm a CPA, I'm looking, you need CPA. End of conversation. Got one of those. Okay? If you're submitting resumes, you're saying, I'm an HR person. I already got one of those. Okay? When you just look just like your competitors, you get automatically rejected because people just make a lot of assumptions. So the reason you want to be unique is because it forces people to actively think about the decision. So we go into Price Club for the very first time, and we're like, oh my God, this is amazing. It's an old airport hangar. And this is a big, it was interesting because it was actually a trade-off for us. You know, we got better prices, but we suffered an inconvenience as a result. Okay? And I know this right firsthand because I was the guy who had to carry everything. I was the oldest son. So my mom would go in there, buy the 25-pound bags of sugar, you know, 300 cans of Coke, like those little snack packs, like the crackers and like the peanut butter, you know, for our lunch bags. And we just she'd buy this stuff like by the hundreds. And I had to clean out the garage to put up extra shelves to store this stuff. I had to haul it all from the warehouse into the car. And I remember when it came time for my mother to upgrade her car, she used to drive a sedan, but she wanted to try one of those new minivans sort of back in the 80s for the main purpose of being able to go to Price Club in one trip instead of two. So we really re-engineered a lot of our lives just to be able to get a better price. And we were willing to do it because it was so different. It was just so different, and it made sense for us. So that's one big benefit of being unique, is it forces the decision maker to actually make a decision by thinking, not just through instinct and being on an autopilot rejection mode. Okay. The second reason it's important to be unique is that when you're unique, you get a lot more word of mouth marketing. Let me explain. Last year, Costco, as the company is now known as, did $70 billion in sales. And they did pretty much no advertising, close to zero. Ever seen a TV ad? Ever seen them advertise in the newspaper? Ever get a direct mail piece? You know, maybe a membership renewal. That's about it. At best, you get some coupons or a flyer on your way in the store, in the warehouse. $70 billion in sales, no advertising. Okay, who can do no advertising? Right? Not that complicated. But the reason that business created $70 billion is because of how unique it was. And people like me talking about it for the better part of 30 years. Okay? And when I was a kid, we would tell, we went to the Costco, Price Club for the very first time. We came back, we told all our neighbors, you'll never believe this place. The prices are absurdly cheap, but you got to buy them in like, huge quantities. I remember when we had relatives come in from overseas. I'm Chinese by ethnicity, so we have relatives come in from Asia. And we'd always take them in Southern California to two places. Take them first to Disneyland because they want to see the whole Mickey Mouse thing. And then we took them to Price Club. Okay? I got to tell you, far more impressed with Price Club. Okay? Chinese people, culturally, were kind of frugal. So this sort of was very appealing. And they would go back and tell my other relatives, you'll never believe this Price Club thing. Forget the Disneyland thing. Go to the Price Club. And so they'd come the next year. We'd host them. And then we go to Price Club first and then go to Disneyland, right? And it was so interesting and so different that it forced people to talk about it, okay? I remember that my mother, she was a small business owner, both my parents were. They would send her, she would send her employees to go when she couldn't go herself. They would come back amazed, eyes like, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. And they would tell their family members, they'd become members, they'd tell their neighbors, they'd tell their family, and business spread, totally by word of mouth because of how different it was. So a practical tip, you know, if you have unique skills as a professional or if your business has anything about it that's unique, crank up the uniqueness. Make it, if you're a little bit different, make it a lot more different. If you're already a lot different, make it even more extreme. Turn up that uniqueness. It makes it easier to get the attention of decision makers. So let me give you some examples. When I was in Texas, I met the owner of a plumbing company. And it was, I forget, the tagline of the business was, we're the punctual plumber. So we don't argue that, I'll speak on their behalf. They aren't making the argument that they fix your pipes better. They just make the argument that they show up on time. Okay? Because every other plumber doesn't. Right? And they put their money where their mouth is. For every minute they're late, they pay you $5. Okay? Does that sound different? Sounds different, right? Now, for those of you who have had to call service professionals out to your home or place of business, they give you these absurd, like windows. Like, we'll be there somewhere between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, stay home from work and just sit there? I mean, I got a life to go and run, right? And so she's solving a very interesting problem. Are people busy in a recession? Arguably even busier, right? Is being on time important? It's important. Okay. So if you need to be a plumber to be on time, you know who to call in that local market. It's unique. When I was telling this story, I actually had someone else in the audience come out and tell me, and he explained that his father used to be a plumber in the Great Depression. And lived in Brooklyn, out in New York City, and explained that he had a really interesting situation. The plumber would work on apartment buildings, like the plumbing for big apartment buildings. And the hot water heaters, they call them boilers, would fail every 5 years or so. That's just how long they were rated for. And the landlords were very reluctant to replace it, but they sort of had to do something. And a water boiler, I guess, just looks like this big cylindrical device, and you sort of heat it up, and it makes hot water, and you pipe it up to all the tenants. And so this person's father explained to me that that his father invented a new solution. He would take the water heater, and rather than try to replace it, which all the other plumbers in the Great Depression were offering to do for a lot of money, he offered to turn the water boilers upside down. All the leaks were at the bottom, because that's the part that gets the heat. And it had a leak, and it would leak, and you couldn't get any hot water in the building. So he offered to just cut it off, turn it upside down so the leak is above. But because of gravity, the water never comes out. Okay? And was able to offer this service. And it usually got people an extra 3 years of life out of their water boilers. And no other plumber had figured this out. So he had all of the business, all of it, in Brooklyn in the Great Depression. Okay? He offered something unique. That's why being unique is important. It makes your competitors less and less relevant. All right, so that's rule number three, solve customer problems in a unique way. Let's talk about rule four, and we'll transition and do some questions and answers. Rule four is when you follow the other rules, be more aggressive in your marketing efforts. efforts. So if you have turned the trend into your friend by solving a problem that customers still care about, much like FedEx did, right, for the computer companies, and if you are solving those problems in a unique way, like Price Club and Costco does for their customers, when you follow those two rules, the right move is to be more aggressive in your outreach, your marketing, your sales efforts. Okay. Let me give you an example. Domino's Pizza started in 1960 in the midst of a recession. An interesting tidbit with Domino's, it was started by two brothers. Okay. One of the brothers, after about 8 months, chickened out. He said, this recession stuff just ain't for me. You know, this business is going to fail. Okay. And the remaining brother, Tom Monahan, decided to buy his brother out in exchange for a used car. Okay. Tom Monahan later, by the way, sold that business for $1 billion. I would have paid money to be there at Thanksgiving dinner to see how that went. But for the first couple of years, first 15 years or so in Domino's history, they focused on delivering hot pizza fast. Okay, this was before the big marketing campaign that you probably have heard of. And they just focused on the operational side of delivering a hot pizza fast. Okay? And this is what it involved. Okay? At the time, all the other delivery services were also restaurants. Okay? And for those of you who are familiar with retail-type businesses, you want to be in a high-traffic neighborhood. Okay, that's where you get a lot of your sales from. But if you're in delivery, there's no point in having a high-traffic destination location. So they would change. Over time, the Domino's formula for operations evolved to be very different than the typical restaurant. They got rid of all the tables and chairs, okay? So they shrunk the amount of real estate they needed. This gave them more options, right? Because they could fit into smaller spaces than a big restaurant. They realized that it was important to be close to customers, not necessarily have a lot of foot traffic in front of the store. So their real estate strategy was probably closer to, say, UPS than like a McDonald's. Better to be close, in fact, so they can get delivered faster. And they changed the ovens they used. They changed the recipes so it could bake faster. They did a lot of things to get the fast hot pizza there. Okay? That was the first 15 years until about the mid-70s. And then in the mid-70s, they decided that the business was working pretty well. It was growing. And the mid-70s, they decided that we want to go big. Okay? And how do we go bigger? And this is where their ad agency noticed this sort of delivery trend. Something like 98% of their pizzas were delivered within 30 minutes or less. And the agency said, I think that's pretty unique. But how many people actually know this fact, that you deliver 98, 99% of the time within 30 minutes or less? It was a statistical certainty before it became a marketing promise. Okay? And so they just did the big marketing campaign that you're probably familiar with. Hot, fresh pizza delivered to your door in 30 minutes or less, guaranteed, or it's free. Okay, and they used that marketing slogan for 20 years, unchallenged. Okay? Not that anyone didn't try. They tried, but they couldn't match the operational side. They had to deal with the big restaurant facilities with all the table and the space for tables and chairs. They had all the real estate in the wrong places for delivery, after high traffic areas, not places that were close to customers. So they could match the marketing promise, they just couldn't deliver. And so notice that Domino's had a very unique business. It gave them the option to be a very recession-proof organization. But it's only after they marketed that uniqueness very aggressively that they prospered from it. Okay? So I'll translate this into sort of more practical terms. So for those in the room who are employees working for other organizations, it means if you have a unique resume, a unique skill set, it does you no good to keep that information to yourself. Okay? You have to emphasize it, and you have to get it out there. But it's not worth getting out there unless it's unique. Okay. All right, interesting. I'll give you one local example, and then we'll break for questions and answers. I was giving a speech down in Los Gatos, and I had a dentist who was in my audience. And he had actually been in the audience maybe 4 months earlier when I was also in town there giving a separate speech on the same topic. And he liked it so much the first time he came back to hear it again. I was sort of impressed by that. Wasn't expecting it. And he said, your first speech, the first time I heard your speech, you really left an impression, this last point about being aggressive in your marketing. And he sort of took that to heart, and he was wanting to report the good news. And he told me that he's still doing fine. Like, if you look at his financials, you can't tell there's a recession. He's not growing, which he'd prefer to do. He's flat, which, considering the economy, it's not bad. Right? He's had to work harder for it. And the reason he's able to hold steady is because of the more aggressive marketing that he's been able to do. And so I asked him, so what did you do? What are you promising to your customers, and what kind of marketing methods are you using? And he said, it's not even, like, I looked at his marketing. It wasn't even that good, really. Okay? The main message really was, I'm a dentist in Los Gatos, and I'm still in business. Okay? So the Yellow Page ad is still there. And the internet presence is still there. If you search for a dentist on Yelp, you know, it's a site that some people use for customer reviews, he's like the number one person there. If you go to the local grocery store, like he's got all the little seats. You know how they have a little ad on the seats where you put your kid's butt on? Like his picture is like on those seats. And by perception and in comparison, all his competitors have pulled back, canceled the Yellow Page ad, reduced the internet presence, cut back on advertising. So when someone new moves into town and you want to know who should you use as a dentist, there's only like one guy from a perception standpoint. Okay? And perception is reality. How are you supposed to know he's not the only one? Because everyone other dentist is hiding. Okay? So in that particular business, you know, it's not that competitive. It's not like these national businesses. You know, being unique is simply saying, we're still in business. Right? And sometimes that's enough. It's funny. I was talking to an auto parts supplier based out of Detroit, $100 million a year business. And when they submit proposals to the big three automakers, you know, they used to have to like fight left and right to like win the business. And now what they do is they submit the proposal and they submit a financial statement that shows they have like $150 million in cash in the bank. Okay? And their message is, we will deliver, we'll deliver well, we will deliver on time, and we are still in business. We challenge you to ask the same of our other competitors. Okay? And they make the, like in the automatic transmissions, the little button you push to like change the gear, they make that button for like every auto manufacturer in the world. I mean, they're like the button maker. I was just very impressed by the, I guess, you know, someone's going to make it, right? So it's an interesting story. Okay, so that's sort of, let me wrap up with a quick summary, and I'll take some questions. I'm happy to answer them. If I don't get a chance to answer your questions, there's a website you can go to. It's for my free online newsletter. Ask your questions. I usually answer them in my email newsletter. Just go to askvictor.com, www.askvictor.com. I usually update new stories, new case studies, new tips around my teachers because I always learn new information like to share. Okay, so when I start off my talk, I talked about the economy overall, and my big message on the economy was learn to expect the unexpected. Okay, that's probably the most safe mindset you can have as it relates to the economy. I talked about the four rules of building a recession-proof business, career, organization. First rule is to focus on the opportunities, not the problems that remain in the recession. Focus on the opportunities. And I had three big tips there. First is to remember the money is still out there, $13.3 trillion, to be specific. Second tip related to that rule is to be careful of the media. Take what they say with a grain of salt. They skew more negative than positive. And the third tip was to learn to adapt or die, like the cargo industry of New York City. They adapt, so they never die. The second rule is to turn the trend of customer spending patterns into your friend. So solve problems that customers still care about in a recession. Rule three is to be unique in whatever it is you do for customers or for your employer. And rule four is when you follow the other rules, market aggressively. You've already laid the foundation for having a recession-proof career, recession-proof business, but it doesn't do any good unless you get the word out. So it's very important that you be aggressive in getting that word out. Great. On that note, let me wrap up and ask if there are any questions. If you do have one, please use the microphone in the back, and I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, let's put our hands together first for Victor, please. want to remind our audience, we're listening to Victor Cheng, who is a marketing consultant, and talking to us about prospering in a recession. I guess I'll lead off, if I may. So many of the things you refer to here seems to call forth the need for creativity and innovation, whether it be, again, personal or organizational. And I think quite often many of us get into a sort of a mental block, say, oh, gosh, I'm just not a very creative person, or organizations can do that too. So what are your thoughts around issues of just getting into a creative mode or creativity and innovation in general? What are some of your thoughts around that?
It's interesting. I'll share a little story. I was giving a similar speech to a group of CEOs of mid-sized businesses. Smallest business in the room represented was probably $5 million a year in sales. Biggest was $200 million. So very accomplished, probably $1 billion in revenues represented by a dozen or so leaders in the room. And as an example of the things I talked about today, I said, what you really got to do is go out and talk to your customers, figure out what it is they want now that's different than they wanted 2 years ago. And what was interesting was this was like, they thought it was like the most brilliant insight on planet Earth, because it hadn't occurred to them to like go ask the people with the money, what do you want in exchange for the money? Okay. And And here's my message around that. It's impossible to be creative while under stress. Okay, that is the first part of your brain that shuts down. Okay, in the human being as well as in organizations. When you're in a crisis mode, it's very hard to think very clearly in very simplistic terms. So when people come back and look and analyze this recession 10 years from now, they'll be like, well, why didn't these guys just do these simple things? Okay? Because in the midst of a crisis, in the burning building, it doesn't occur to you to, like, you know, do certain basic things. So what I always try to do is, in terms of getting into creative mode, you have to decompress somehow. Okay, so if you're feeling stressed, you just have to find some way to get rid of that. Lots of ways to do that. Yoga, meditation, exercise, any of that stuff is all great. And the second thing is to come up with ideas in a structure. Okay, so not just come up with ideas randomly, but in a structured way. And so one of the exercises I tell my clients to do, for example, is go out into town, look for a line of customers lining out the door. Whenever you see the line of customers lining out the door, you go get in the back of the line and figure out what's in the front of the line. Okay. And I did that recently, and I discovered cupcakes. Huge line for cupcakes down on the peninsula. Beats me, why? But I got in there and I figured it out. So it's paying attention to where the money is still being spent. Okay. So if you are a job seeker, I would recommend going to hot jobs. And don't just look for the kind of jobs you can do. Go look for who has the most job postings. Okay. And go figure out what industry they're in. Follow the money, and then figure out what you can do for that industry. So there's a couple of sort of practical tips, but in general, you got to sort of detach a little bit. You have to realize it's possible, too. So that's one reason I give speeches and write books and share my message with folks, is most people don't even realize that it's possible to win, and they have no role model to go against in terms of companies who've made it. And so the examples I use in my book, I give on my website, they sort of highlight those and sort of shows you what's possible, and that helps sort of jar the stir up the creativity process.
Other questions from the audience?
Thank you very much for tonight. It's interesting. You mentioned marketing-oriented things, focusing on unique attributes and finding the river where it is. But you didn't mention anything about cost-cutting or laying people off or tightening belts. And is there any trend in your research towards companies that did that or...
I would say I have a point of view on cost-cutting, layoffs, and that kind of stuff. I didn't get that information from our research. It's sort of more a contemporary observation. I think it does not make sense to simply cut costs arbitrarily, okay? Because you can't shrink to greatness. I think it makes a lot of sense to cut very deliberately to free up resources to fund the things that make you unique, to fund getting the word out on what makes you already unique. And so I have clients who have done cost cutting, but it was usually in this context. We have three parts of the business. One's doing okay. One is sucking wind and is basically struggling. And one's doing surprisingly well given the recession. Okay? So the tough thing is, well, what's going to pull you out of the recession? It's the one that's working the best. Okay? So we would cut the one-third of the company that wasn't doing well. It just happened to be the wrong business at the wrong time given the economy. And we took all those resources, the dollars and the people, and we moved them. And we doubled the investment and the part of the business that was working. Simplest way to tell, by the way, what part, what's working or not, is just in your own businesses and your own personal income. Follow the money. What's making you the most money? And whether you realize it or not, that's the business you're really in, because that's the one that's working. does that help address your question? Sure.
Victor, yes. Tell us about your most recent experience on MSNBC or Fox News or whatever, just out of curiosity, because I noticed on your website that you frequent those and... What's the most recent one in Tulsa?
Let's see. I remember actually the most recent one, actually it was for a website, it was for Monster.com. They were doing an article on business opportunities triggered by the stimulus package. Right? And it's interesting, I actually read the stimulus bill. I just do these kinds of things. And I went line item by line item. So there's like the $1 trillion, it's split up into like maybe like 300 categories. And I got to tell you, that money is being spread so wide and so far. Right, there is a little bit of money for pretty much every sector of the economy. Okay? And the big message there was there's sort of no one industry that's going to sort of prosper unusually well because of the stimulus, that the money is being spread so wide. For example, most of the stimulus is in tax cuts. Okay? So it's going into minor pockets. That what really makes sense to do is start a business that makes sense for you. What are you good at? What do you have that's unique to offer relative to what customers want? Start that business rather than some arbitrary business that you know nothing about, just because it happens to be in a stimulus bill. So that was sort of probably the most recent, one of the more recent interviews then, and sort of an interesting insight there.
Victor, if we're to believe the media, France and Germany are out of the recession. They're not necessarily known to be the most creative business people. How do you figure that to be the case?
I haven't followed their numbers very well. I've been focusing mostly on the U.S. But I'll tell you that those who did not spend as much and borrow as much before the recession, my guess is they probably come out of it much faster. I think the reason this one's so severe is because the level of spending and borrowing was really unprecedented. I mean, the level of interest rates, the ease of which you could get money was really sort of unprecedented in a lot of ways, and that sort of drove the excess. And so now the severity of the hangover is precisely proportional to the severity of the drinking beforehand. So that's for the situation. That's my best guess as to what's happening there. Yes, sir.
Yeah, my question is the lines that I've noticed. I went by DMV today. Huge line. I also noticed that government services, longer lines, less service, less work. The state is like, so I'm wondering, do you see any opportunities for alternative services? In other words, a teaching corps of enthusiastic parents, a elder community that actually has fun and does something rather than, you know, goes to the retirement home. A volunteer adjunct to the fire department or some sort of, thugs for hire with the police department. You know what I mean? I mean, there are things where the costs are huge. And, you know, every cop costs, what, $150,000 a year, and they don't get there on time. So it seems that neighborhood watch groups or, you know, you can't use the word vigilante, but there seems to be services and community wellness that there's some opportunities there.
I have sort of a personal rule. I just try to stay out of government affairs, mostly because some things that make sense from a common sense practical standpoint just are really politically very unpopular. But I think for some of those things, I think there's an opportunity. I'll give you some simple example. I have young kids, and, you know, we've been looking at public school versus private schools and doing the research on both, and I've been talking to some of the admissions directors. I'm always curious, you know, who's making money and why. And they're telling me that they, particularly in the Bay Area, they all talk to one another. It's not surprising. And that, would you believe that admission applications for admissions at private schools in the Bay Area are way up versus prior to the session? And that's like, well, it seems counterintuitive, right? Because it's like absurdly expensive to afford private school here. And so why are more people interested in it, even though in the Bay Area that people have less money? And the big driver apparently is parents that are concerned that the public school won't be funded. So the quality will go down, this is the fear, so they're willing to pony up more, whereas in a boom year they wouldn't. So that's sort of a way of sort of noticing sort of a hidden trend, right? I think some of the services, I think there's potential for the private sector to take over. And sort of encroach on that. The real answer, the one I really like the most, but I don't think will ever be politically popular, is sort of a partnership between the private and public sector. You know, like, let me run the DMV. Give me the budget, you know. I'll do something different. Trust me, it'll be very different than what you see there. But I doubt that will ever, ever happen. So, yes, sir.
You said half of the Fortune 500 were born in recession. Mm-hmm. I'm curious, can you make any characterization of those companies who are starting in good economy and those companies who start business in bad economy?
Yeah.
Is there any difference in characterization or business model?
So is there any difference in capitalization, financial assets available for invest? Unfortunately, I don't have that information. My sense is that the companies that start in a recession, they took advantage of a couple of things. So the first thing is labor is a lot cheaper, okay? So I'm having all my clients go out and, like, upgrade their teams. You can pay a little bit less, pay more in terms of, like, performance-based, so you actually make more money, but get a much higher quality person. I'll give you another example, Tesla Motors, right, which is the big startup here in Silicon Valley with doing the electric sports car. Two things of interest. The dealership they have in Menlo Park sits on the site of the old Ford Lincoln Mercury dealership that is no longer there. Tesla is building, I believe, a 90 or 180-acre auto manufacturing plant in San Jose. They already have the site, and that's what their goal is. Their entire senior management team consists of former Ford, GM, Chrysler executives that were smart enough to leave a couple years ago because they sort of saw the writing on the wall. And my guess is that Tesla would have a much harder time recruiting that caliber of talent in the boom economy, right? So in recession, labor frees up. Okay? Another example, for many years, past decade or so, a lot of people who were rocket scientists, PhD, mathematics, advanced sciences, they go work for Wall Street, okay, and apply their engineering skills to financial engineering. Okay? That is not a good sector to be in right now. Those engineers, who are, a lot of them are brilliant, like the smartest folks out of each PhD program, are now going back to inventing new technologies that build the new industries, the new inventions that fund our future. Okay? It's the better place for them to be, from my perspective. But the funny money that was out there in the prior decade or so created an artificial attraction, but now we have the talent flowing back into where they can really provide a lot of long-term value. So I think that the big advantage in the, for companies in the recession really is taking advantage of labor, both talent and cost, and being very nimble and being very fast about it.
Victor, what about speed in the internet age here? In other words, we hear a lot about change cycles are much more rapid, and how does that speak toward, if you will, the issue of thoroughness and deliberateness of decision-making versus the be far more experimental kind of mode? How do you see that spectrum?
That's interesting. I always make this joke that my personal income last year exceeded that of General Motors. I lost less than $14 billion last year. And if GM doesn't make it, it will be because they were too slow, not because they were too big or too small. Size isn't as important as speed. In terms of making the decision, here's what I've been telling my clients. If it's not working, kill it. Okay? There's no point. I was doing a radio interview this morning here at a local station, and this person with a caller called in and said, my business is going to fail. What should I do? Okay. My response was simple. Make it fail faster. Get it over with. Cut your losses. As an entrepreneur, as a career professional, you are in the business of winning the war. It's okay to lose a battle, but just get it over with faster. Conserve your resources so you can live to fight another day. And I think in terms of being fast, I have all my clients being very experimental. The hard part, again, is you don't know what's going to work. Okay, you do your homework, you do your research, you have some educated guesses as to what customers want. But there's there's no service that tells you, customers now want this instead of that. You got to do the hard work of figuring it out. And so there has to be a lot of experimentation. The key with experimenting is invest very small amounts to do the minimum necessary to figure out something's worth going after. If it works, then increase your investment. So it's sort of like go a little bit wide, almost like a shotgun approach initially. Once you find something that's working, you cut everything else. And you focus on the one thing that's working. So this could be, I'll give you a career example. If you have a particular background, let's say I'll use the rocket scientist example. You have a rocket scientist degree, and you apply to Wall Street, and they keep rejecting you, and you apply to all these sort of new technology startups that are in solar power, wind power, turbine power, and all of a sudden they're interested in, you have like interviews left and right. Okay? It doesn't take a genius to figure out that Wall Street's not where the action is for you. You better focus on what's working. So in your own careers, there are certain skills that may not have been your primary skills in your career. Okay? Maybe you have some secondary skills. And you may find that your secondary skills that you almost forgot about and took for granted, or your secondary products or your secondary services that you don't normally emphasize, might actually be doing better, might be more desirable to the other side in this environment. And it's a bit of a mental shift to sort of do that. Sort of like the sign company. Who was equally good, secondary services was taking down signs and going out of business signs. It wasn't the business he wanted to be in. It wasn't the business he thought he was in, but he was wise enough to realize, the business he wants to be in isn't there anymore. These other businesses really are thriving, so he switched. And that's the mental shift that has to happen.
I have a question.
Yes,
first
please.
Of all, thank you very much for your presentation.
Sure.
It's been actually really good, simplified, and to the point. I'm going to ask a bit of a challenging question
because it's
a challenge I have been going across. About 4 years ago, I started in the clean tech industry in renewable energy. And when I started, most people weren't really aware of it, didn't quite understand it, et cetera. And today, I find myself in twofolds I'm challenged. One is I'm consulting, and my business has dipped. And the second challenge is if I want to actually go back into the industry as a full-time employee, which would be an executive, I'm finding myself competing again. So let me tell you where I'm competing.
Okay.
And not to take this personally, but I'm competing in which the clean tech sector now is getting inundated by the big five consulting firms.
Okay.
So strategists like me isn't the big brand name of BCG or McKinsey. And if I want to compete and go back as an executive, the companies that are getting funding want to hire people out of the Ivy League schools. I have 20 years of business experience, but my MBA came out of a UK school. So I'm wondering if you could maybe shed some creative light
sure.
on how do I go about trying to meet this challenge.
A couple thoughts. One sort of general rule of thumb I think is useful for the whole audience, and then something more specific for you. When you're looking at the kinds of problems you can solve for customers or for employers, there's always a continuum. There are the problems that are urgent and the problems that make sense but aren't urgent. Okay? And in this particular environment, the only ones that get funded, the only ones that get hired, the only ones that get sort of selected are the ones solving the urgent problems. Okay? So if you look at your particular set of skills, or anyone's frankly in the room, if there's a range of things you can do for the person on the other side, and only one of them is super urgent that they want fixed right now, that's the one you got to go with. Okay? The second thing in terms of your background strikes me as very interesting, and I think I'm going to challenge you back a little bit. You may be making a lot of assumptions as to what companies, employers want. I'm sure some of them value the things that you talked about as being competitive to you, but my bet is there's probably a segment in there, certain kinds of categories of employers that would actually prefer your experience and expertise. Mm-hmm. But they may not. I find people with a very diverse background sometimes what they value most isn't what you've been emphasizing. Right? So what you might want to do is, in a non-interview setting, go talk to a bunch of these executives and say, listen, I'm looking to sort of do a transition in my career. Here's my background. Can you give me some career advice? What of my, like the 97 things I could do, which one would you value the most? And get that market feedback. Because I'll tell you, I did that in my own business. And back in October, the reason I did this research was because in my business, half of my business disappeared in 24 hours, the day after the crash. I have two parts of my business. One part serves larger companies. An awful lot of them were in the finance sector. Okay, so I had this, like, holy crap moment. You know, I got, like, two kids. I throw it on the way, and, like, there's, like, the income went in half. Like, oh. That's why I did the research, right? It was very much selfishly motivated, trust me. I also noticed once I calmed down to talk about creativity, I sort of, like, took a chill pill and took a deep breath and said, okay, let's go back to the basics. I noticed the other half of the business had not changed one bit. No dip. Zero. I was like, that's interesting. How come? And so what I suggested to you, go figure out why. I started doing homework. Well, why do these customers like me? I was afraid to ask them the question because I was afraid they would change their minds. So, oh, yeah, we should fire you. Yeah, okay. But I quietly asked and said, well, you do these things for me. Oh, I didn't even realize. You know, and these are some of my consulting clients, and a couple things in their case, you know, they value the fact that I had an answer for everything. They value the fact that beyond sort of the analytical stuff, I was so clearly in their corner, and they felt that at an emotion level. So it was really like one of the few people in their sphere that, you know, really wanted them to do well, and that was sort of in short supply. And if you look at that, that's not anywhere in my marketing. It's not on my website. I never talk about that. In fact, I didn't even realize it was happening. Now that they told me about it, well, I learned. And I emphasize now on the website. I have videos about it. You know, I talk about it in white papers. So it was really using that market feedback of what's unique about me, what do you value, and then taking that information and applying it to your prospects. So in your case, it's talk to people who are in the industry and say, hey, here's my background. What about me is unique to you, that you would you value? And then put that in the resume, put that in the cover letter, put that in the sales proposals. My bet is you'll have much better luck with doing that.
It brings to mind that we were talking about creativity before, and I remember years ago I heard the director of creativity for Disney talking about what creativity is, and he says it's the making of the new, the rearranging of the old. And it brought to mind the issue of sometimes how we repackage things.
Absolutely.
Can be very important. And what I'm hearing you say throughout all this is to rediscover and revisit some of these basic assumptions, and maybe one needs to be emphasized more than another, perhaps de-emphasized or something. So it isn't always having to come up with the brand new thing. Is that something you do?
Absolutely. I mean, and just in my personal case, you know, I took the half of the business that was working and I doubled it in like 6 months. Worked like hell to do it, pulled it off, but because of the market feedback. I always tell people that you want to find a better recipe for the existing ingredients you have in your business, in your career, in your background. Okay, same ingredients, new recipe, right? I'll make a big guess. I'm sure there are skills in there in your background that are unique, right? But the priority you place on certain skills and the priority an employer or a client places on those skills is probably mismatched. You got to figure out what they want and repackage things in the form that they prefer to see it in.
Victor, we have reached that point where I want to give you an opportunity to send us away with the what I'll say the one nugget. I remember the movie City Slickers where the character played by Jack Palance tells Billy Crystal, he says, there's the one thing. And so you've given us four rules, and each of the rules has a couple of tidbits and tips and so forth. But what is the one thing you'd suggest we leave here tonight with a nugget to reflect on?
I think of all the points I mentioned, if you walk away with only sort of one message, it's very simple. I'll cheat. I'm going to give you two messages. Number one is follow the money. Number two is adapt or die. If you just do those two things, follow the money, adapt or die, you'll be all right. Certainly be better than everyone else, and you'll probably be all right.
Thank you, Victor Cheng.
Sure.
I also want to remind our audience that the Commonwealth Club staff person was just here. I think he is right there. He's ready to sell some of the books up there if you'd like to take a look at Victor's book. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.